this passage, an incredible passage. I'm going to bypass verses 1 to 3 this morning. Don't think that I'm leaving them out. Next week, just so you can be in preparation, we're going to have communion next week. And our focus will be on this passage again, and we will come back to look unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. There's a reason for taking this passage a bit out of, not out of order, but just taking the verses 4 through 13 before we take verses 1 to 3, so that maybe by God's grace we will understand a bit of the impact of verses 1 to 3 when we come back and look at it again. Now let me just give you a setting, and you look at the setting with me. First of all, we're dealing with people who had suffered unbelievable trials. If there's anything that continues to impress me as I go through this part of the book this time, is that this is not some renegade bunch of believers. This is not some very errant people. This is a very loving household church that the author dearly loves. And his heart is broken to think that anybody would waver in their walk with God. And so he writes to them. Now, first of all, you go back with me, if you will, to chapter 10, and you'll notice that in chapter 10, verses 32 and following, these were people who, first of all, in verse 32, had been made a public spectacle. They had been publicly ridiculed and shamed. Secondly, it says that they were those who had received insults, reproaches, is how it's in this context. It is the fact that they had been verbally abused, not privately, my friend, publicly verbally abused. Accusations made which they could never, ever defend. Thirdly, they had been publicly, physically abused. All you have to do is look at the life of Paul himself, right? In Philippi, beat and put into prison. So we're dealing with people who had been publicly ridiculed. They'd been verbally abused. They'd been physically abused. The property, according to this passage, had been seized on the part of many of them. Look, you joyfully accept the seizure of your property. They had been taken out of homes to be put into jail, and by the time they got back, people had come into their houses that were left unattended, and they'd taken everything out that they wanted, or else they had been sent out of Rome because of their belief in Christ, like Priscilla and Aquila, and when they got back, the house was taken over by somebody else. Secondly, you'll notice, though, in this thing that the trials, and we'll come to it in just a moment, were becoming more intense. Well, they're not backing off. Even if you will with me for a while, when it says that, you know, some of you are not assembling yourselves together, may I suggest to you the reason? Now, there was a letter, by the way, sent to a church in Rome years later that suggested that the people were doing it because they were so involved in business situations that they were not coming. I don't think that's likely the situation here for the church that is addressed, this household church. Rather, the persecution was becoming so intense that to go to the house of God identified you with the people of God and therefore made you more susceptible to being imprisoned, as he talks about here, visiting the prisoners and caring for the prisoners, the more chance of being imprisoned and having your life taken. He says you have not yet withstood to the shedding of blood, but some had. The trials were becoming more intense than they had been before, and the people, some of them, were fearful of what would happen. And if you think about when he put in there, not assembling yourselves together, and then he says encouraging one another, can you imagine the encouragement when you decided to go to church, even if you knew it could cost your life, and you saw somebody else there? We're not just talking about some just general encouragement. We're talking about the fact that you saw somebody else willing to, in a sense, jeopardize their own life to go to church, and you said, you know what, this is good. I'm not alone. The other thing that you find in this passage, without a doubt, and right here in chapter 12, is the problem with these people is, notice this statement in verse 3, the last few words of verse 3, that you may not grow weary and lose heart. Some of them were growing weary. Some of them were starting to somehow just lose that confidence they'd had before. I mean, this is, by the way, why? You look at verse 3, do not grow weary and lose heart. You look at verse 13, strengthen your hand. Verse 12, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble. Don't take that out of context. Understand, these people were becoming weary. These people were becoming, in the sense of this point, they were losing heart. Look at the word in verse 5. Do not faint. Weariness, losing heart, fainting. Weak knees, weak hands. Becoming discouraged, these people were. And by the way, this is a long, long deal. You know, we look at the Christian life. I mean, look at what he says, if you will, in verse 1. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. By the way, this is no 100-yard dash, my friends. This is no 220. This is no quarter mile. I was running in the LA Marathon, and I met a man for the first time. I've introduced him, so we met down there to run together. He was a Christian fireman, and we'd never met before, but we ran together. And then on the way, he said to me, he says, you know, I run these 100-milers. He says, you know, could you come run the last 25 miles with me? We're allowed to have people do that. And I said, not on your life. 26 miles is bad. 100 miles. Who in the wide world would think of running 100 miles? Did you hear me carefully here? 26 is bad enough. Do you understand the point of this in this passage? This is not some short race. This is a long race. The sin that so easily besets us is the danger of wanting to give up before you finish the race. You know, I was in very good shape going into Boston, but Boston, I was told, there's a Heartbreak Hill, and someone said, that's not going to be a problem. It actually wasn't. I like going up hills, but Boston has these ups and downs like this. And he told me what happened, and it did. 3 miles from the end, I ran the day after the LA Marathon. I went out running, no problem. The day after the Boston is a joke. I went out to run, and I barely could move, and I watched guys. We could walk upstairs. You could tell anybody who'd run the marathon. Walking downstairs, they had to hold on to railings. Because 3 miles from the end, oh, goodness, the calves were going. Now, I know God doesn't really care too much about finishing marathons, but I said, Lord, help me finish this thing. But, you know, the point of it is, you know, you want to quit. This is a long race. It's a long race. I've seen so many Christians who get on a spurt. All of a sudden, they run so well for a while, and boy, they look so godly, but it just doesn't last. You want to run well. You want to finish well. How do you think of Paul? I finish the race. Huh? I finish the race. I kept the faith, see? Or Jesus, glorify me with the glory which I had before. I have finished the work which you gave me to do. See, I finished. Now, let me show you something else in here. It's not only a long race. Look at something else in here. You don't want to miss this. See, the connection of this, if you look at verses 39 of chapter 11 and 40, this is all of these. And then it says, they are not, notice what happened. Well, let's read. All of these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised because God had provided something better for us. They, the witnesses of chapter 11, and us. They're introduced again in verse 1 of chapter 12. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses, there again, all of these surrounding us, let us. You see, we have a whole bunch of people who've walked before us, who've gone through tough times. Tough times. We read the list last week. Gideon, Jephthah, David. I love David. You know why I love David? The man who ran so long from Saul but would never touch him. Wouldn't kill him. He stood right by him when he was sleeping and got through all of his men and wouldn't kill him. No. And then, so repented because he cut a corner of his garment off and killed the man who claimed to have killed him. A man who, when Saul died, could have taken over the kingdom, but for years ruled in the southern kingdom till God gave him the whole kingdom. Restoration. Ran. Oh, the time that he's taken captive and acted like an insane fool just to be able to get out of there. All of those tough times waiting for God's final move in his life. All of these witnesses, they left an example for us, see. But look at something else here, and I don't want you to miss it, and it's tough to see it in English, but I'll try to help you out. We're looking in the Greek, and I see two words in verse 4. It is first of all the word resisted, and the second one is the word striving. They are found nowhere else in all of the Greek Bible. I'm talking about now, nowhere else in the New Testament, Old Testament, and Greek version, nowhere else. These are the only place they're found. These are athletic terms. What they deal with, we've run away now from running. We've now got to boxing. I'm serious. You know, it's interesting because from this point on, we've moved from just running to boxing. They had a pentathlon in their competition, and this was part of it was boxing, and boxing was the toughest part of it. You know when it says you have not resisted the shedding of blood? I think it has to do with martyrdom, but a good argument can be made for the fact that you see in the boxing, Seneca, a Stoic who wrote at this very time, says that a man was not a true athlete until he saw his own blood. I mean, just to go out there and fight wasn't enough. You needed to see some blood flow to know that you truly were a true athlete. But the point of whatever it is, that fits, the other fits, the point of it is we're getting into something far worse than just running. We're now into a boxing mode, and the opponent is there, and the fight is on. And may I say to you, you're in it. This isn't a choice you make. Now, with regard to this, then, and I want to just talk to you for a bit this morning, because you can handle things like this if you understand why, see? See, look at the first part of this passage. Look at about Jesus. Notice the statement about Jesus. It says, let us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter, verse 2 of faith, who, look at, for the joy set before him endured the cross. See, he knew why he was doing it. He knew why. See, you understand, it's not bad to fight like this if you know why you're fighting. You don't just want to fight, my friend. Nobody wants to get beat up for nothing. Now, just for a while, just to help me and you understand this, walk back with me to Philippians, just for a moment. Philippians chapter 1. Now, it's interesting because in Philippians chapter 1, see, Paul began to try, he wanted to understand why. And it's interesting in Philippians chapter 1, we have a group in this church called by this name. Now, it's a great name. He says this, he says, I wish you, Philippians 1:12, I wish you to be knowing this, brethren, that the things which have happened, and I'm trying to translate here, so what have you do? Things which have happened against me have happened rather unto the prokopane of the gospel. Prokopane, that's a term for this. It comes from the idea of cutting beforehand. And since we talk about the military, it's the Army Corps of Engineers who walk ahead of the army to build bridges and to take out trees and to open the way. Paul says, I sit here in prison, and you know what? He says, it doesn't bother me. It may bother you, and I don't have, you know, daily prayer requests, God, get me out of here. I'm just not doing that. Because you don't understand what I found out? I found out that since being here, God has opened doors for the gospel that never would have been opened otherwise. Nobody. But nobody could have creatively come up with an idea of how to reach the special Praetorian Guard in Rome that was so specialized that nobody ever touched them except the higher-ups. And here, chained to Paul 4 hours at a time. By the way, it's interesting because chained to Paul 4 hours at a time, and they're sitting there having to hear him preach to people, teach people, pray to God. You know what? 24 hours a day, six different groups of guys come there. You're talking about 24 people a day. You're touching. No, notice something else in here, by the way. The great part of Philippians 1. Look at this statement he makes. He says, I want you to know the circumstances have turned out for, notice, the greater progress of the proclamation of the gospel, so that my imprisonment... And I would change the way this is translated. My imprisonment has become well known to be in Christ. See, in other words, he says, everybody knows why I'm here. See, it's not just I'm here. I'm a prisoner and I'm a good prisoner. They know why I'm here. That I'm here because I'm in Christ. But you know, look at the next thing. And he says, you know what? And to everyone else. What is everyone else? All the way through the city of Rome. You see, Praetorian Guard go home. They sit with Paul for 4 hours at a time. By the way, there's a great account. Paul is writing in this same book, and he writes about Epaphroditus, and he makes up a word. He says he gambled his life. Not found anywhere else, period, before that time. Picked up later, by the way, the Greek word. And what happens, he saw these Roman guards gambling there in front of him. So when he thought of Epaphroditus, he says, you know what? There's a man who gambled his life. Years later, on the northern coast of Africa, there was a major plague that spread. And the pagans were throwing the sick and the dead out on the streets. And the Christians, taking this very same term that Paul made up with Epaphroditus, they called themselves the gamblers. And they went out there and they cared for the sick and they buried the dead and they spared the city because they would gamble for God. You see, the interesting part about this, when you understand why you're doing it, it's not so bad to do it, right? Are you with me? Let me just one other thing here while we're in Philippians, because it bears on what we're going to come back to in a moment. Look at verse 19, a great statement. And I can't deal with all this, but I know that this, my imprisonment, will turn out for me, notice, unto my salvation. Now, NESB translates deliverance. That's an unfortunate statement. It is not about deliverance, it's about salvation. He says, you know why else I'm here? I'm not only here because of the gospel, I'm here because of my own salvation. Did you understand something just before we go back to Hebrews? You need to hear this for this and put it in perspective. NESB translators put it deliverance because something made sense. Then Paul didn't care if he got out of jail or not. That wasn't even the issue. He understood that God was chiseling, whittling, creating something of him so that one day he stands before God in his presence and he will be what God chiseled him out to be. Do you understand that? Do you understand God is molding each of us? He's chiseling, he's whittling, he's cutting. Because he knows what he wants to create. And it doesn't make any sense to me, but it makes a lot of sense to him. And Paul says, my imprisonment isn't just about the gospel. It's about what God's trying to do in my life to make me what he ultimately wants me to be. And I have no idea what it is, but if this is a part of it, I know that this imprisonment will turn out to that end. And God will enable me to see it through your prayers and the provision of the Spirit of God. But by the way, listen to me carefully with that, and then I'm going to go back to Hebrews. God is whittling me. Oh, God cuts deeply times. Sometimes it's not just a knife. It looks like an axe when he's taking that first part of the wood, right? It is. And you know that feeling, right? And you see, all of this is toward that ultimate salvation, what Peter calls a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. But hear me carefully. He is doing it, and he's giving me the grace by the Spirit of God, but he's giving me the grace through your prayers. I need you, and you need me, right? To get there and make sure we get there. Now, let me take you back to Hebrews. With that in mind, see, you can handle stuff if you understand why. See, let's come back here now to see if we can understand why. Now, let me show you something. It's an interesting thing, and see if we can get it in English as clearly as we can see it in Greek. But what is interesting here is you start in verses 4 and following. There is a word. I read it in verse 5, the word discipline in verse 5, the discipline of the Lord. Look at verse 6, whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. There it is again. Verse 7, it is for discipline that you endure. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? Twice in verse 7. In verse 8, but if you are without discipline. Verse 9, for furthermore we had earthly fathers to discipline. Verse 10, for they disciplined us. Verse 11, all discipline for the moment. You see, you understand? You got to get an idea here. Never in this book have we had the word discipline, and all of a sudden in 8 verses we have it 8 times in 8 verses. You know what? There's a point here, right? Do you think? I think. I mean, it doesn't take, some commentary to tell us that. We see 8 times discipline, and here we've got to know this is about discipline. Now let me put this in perspective then. If I want to understand why I go through the trials I go through, and by the way, talking about those trials, let me just take you back to verse 4 for a moment. He says, in your striving, and this is, like I say, it's an athletic term, in your boxing, if you will, against sin. Now, there are those who think that this sin is sin in one's personal life, the sin that so easily besets. I don't think so. It could be. And if that's where you want to be, it's all right. I do think I fight against sin, but that's not what this passage is about. I think the context is from verse 3. Notice this, for consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself. It isn't my sin that's the issue here. I have enough battles with that, but that's not the point of this passage. I am battling today against sinful forces in this world that are trying to get me to compromise my stand for God. And like I say, it's a very strong term, and they stand in opposition to me, and it's not only my lust that fights against me, it's these forces of sin, and they fight against me, but even these things. Go down to verse 7. Notice this, it is for discipline that you endure. That's the statement right there, if you understand that, see? Why do I go through such agony and suffering and struggling and opposition and whatever you want to name? Why do I go through all of this? Because God is chiseling. Because God is disciplining. You see, you look at it and say, boy, it's terrible, I'm in jail. No, understand, God's disciplining. And by the way, we talk about discipline, and we need to put it in perspective. You know the word discipline comes from the word paidos, which is the word for child. And we talk about disciplining a child biblically. It is positive, and it's also, there's a corrective aspect, but there's a formative aspect to disciplining. Disciplining is that channeling of a life, guiding a life, the firm guidance of a life in a direction and teaching, training, guiding. On the other hand, it is correcting. And if one fails to see the balance of that, one fails to understand. But you see, God uses every trial in my life to guide me, to chisel me, to prepare me for what He deems fit for me to follow and to be. But it changes it all, does it not? They don't do it. See, you think of that, see? You meant it for evil, God meant it for good. Don't you think being put in a well, don't you think being sold, don't you think being in Potiphar's house as a slave, don't you think being in jail prepared Joseph for that which God was chiseling him to be, even on earth, let alone in eternity? You see, none of this, you look at this, so therefore you get the place, you see, there, none of these are accidents. This warfare, this opposition. Oh, we can become so negative on these things that come into our life, but they're positive because nobody, no sinful force against me can do anything that God doesn't step in to intervene in the process of and use it to make me what He has designed for me eternally to be. That's if there's an overall statement, here's that. And once you understand that and you look at any trial you face, all of a sudden the joy that was set before you causes you to do this. Now let me just quickly walk on because we must. Look at the next thing you see, and I'm going to take you back to verse 4 and follow through the passage line by line. Notice this, the other thing that you find in here that we suggest in the outline is not only the fact is that, but look at the statement that's made. First of all, to say to you in this passage, the struggle is against sinful forces. Verse 4, you have not yet resisted the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. The against sin here is, I do not believe, is sin in our lives. It's the sinful forces that come against us, as this context would so clearly define. Secondly, the battle is going to become unbelievably intense. The word here, resisted and striving, found only here in all of biblical literature, telling us that the battle is not going to get easier. The battle is going to become unbelievably intense. And by the way, you haven't seen anything yet. If you go back to the preceding three verses, you see Christ suffer to the point of death. You haven't done that yet. I love a passage. Go with me to 2 Corinthians for a moment. It is so significant because it depends how you want to look at life, my friend. If you want to be negative all of your life, you can. If you want to be biblical, you won't be. Notice this. Let me just quickly give you, define you what happens in 2 Corinthians 6. Notice in verse 3 it says, giving no offense in anything, no cause for offense in anything. Now, when you think about this, how do I keep there from being an offense and keep the ministry from being hindered? Do you know the point of this passage? It's about attitude. It is. Go down with me to the near the end of this passage, and I start with you in verse 8. On the one side, he says, in my life, there's glory. On the other side, there's dishonor. I mean, we'll look at the next statement. On the other side, there's evil report and some good report. Some regard me as a deceiver, and yet I tell the truth. Now look at these verses. He says, that's how people see me. I have people on the one hand who think, you know what, this is the greatest thing that ever happened, and other people who think you were spawned by the devil. He says, I have people saying great things and other people saying terrible things. I have people calling me a liar. And by the way, he changes the construction there because it bothers him. He says, I have people calling me a liar, but I'm truthful. Now that's their view, but now look at my view. Look at the next statements. He makes this statement, he says, as unknown, and yet I'm well known. What is that all about? Here's a Pharisee. This guy was moving up like nobody else was moving up, and then Jesus got hold of his life. He says, now nobody knows me. I've been sitting in prison for 4 years, see? I'm traveling out on the far outreaches of everywhere. I'm stoned and left for dead. I'm put in prison after I'm beat. Nobody knows me, but you know what? God knows me. Look at the next one. He says, I'm dying. I love this. In the first part of the book, he tells us he almost died, and yet he says, you know what? I could sit here and complain about the fact I'm dying, but he says, you know what? I just want to tell you, I'm still alive. Now, this next one I love. He says, you know what? As disciplined, but you know what? He hasn't killed me yet. I love that. You know, God has been disciplining for a long time, my friend, but he still hasn't killed me. Huh? No, this is a great side to it. What side do you want to look at? The negative side or the positive side? I just thank God with all the whittling he does in my life. The fact that it's going to get worse before it gets better. But I got to tell you what, he disciplines and disciplines and disciplines, but he's never killed me yet. What an incredible statement, see? You look at trials, my friend, as for discipline, and understand that the disciplining work of God is going to become intense, it's going to become worse. But you know what? He's not going to take your life. Not yet. Go with me back. Hebrews again. The next statement I want you to look at, now to walk with me now. Understand now the outlook that should accompany suffering. Now, first of all, I look at verse 5. And you, now by the way, I think probably better, may I put it this way, it's a question, not a statement. Have you forgotten, and not exhortation, I think it's encouragement, see? I'll change two things. Make it a question and translate this encouragement. By the way, it's that word, parakaleo, see, which could mean to comfort, to encourage, or to exhort. Well, in this passage, it's about encouragement. Unfortunately, they put that, and he put in a question. Have you forgotten the encouragement? And then look at where the encouragement came from. Notice what it says. Which is addressed to you as sons. And then what does he do? He quotes Scripture. Do you know what? You know the great part about this? Just let me stop there for a while. Do you understand in the midst of suffering, do you not remember the encouragement that God gave you when you went through discouraging times, just as you read His Word and He helped you put things in perspective? Huh? That's the question here. In fact, the matter is it's a beautiful thing because in this passage you're going to talk about a father talking to sons. By the way, we're called as sons. In this passage, the author never calls him father. But let that go. Do you understand God's way of talking to me and communicating to me is through His Word? And how many times you've picked up the Bible to read it and you found an encouragement that just makes your day and sets you on the right course? And that's exactly what he does here. He goes quoting the book of Proverbs because he says, you know, don't you remember what God did and what God said to you and how that brought encouragement to you? Listen. Trials only become discouraging when, in fact, we don't draw upon the encouragement that God gives us in His Word. Now, look at the encouragement and what it is. Just walk with me. The first thing, then, he talks about this. He says, understand the encouragement that accompanies suffering and how that encouragement comes, my friend, is through the Word of God. Now, look at the Word of God as he quotes it. He says, when I read the Bible, all of a sudden, I understood. Why suffering? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint, we'll come back to this, when you are reproved by Him. For those whom the Lord loves, He disciplines, and He scourges every son whom He receives. Do you know what? The word son is found in this passage 6 times in verses 5 through 8. It should tell you something, see? Listen to me carefully. He says, you know what? As you look at this passage, look at verse 8. If you without discipline of which all have become partakers, then you're an illegitimate child and not a son. Listen to me. I am not illegitimate. I'm a son of God. Do you hear me? I am not illegitimate. I am the son of God. Listen to me carefully. If God does not discipline you, then you see He does not care for you, and you are illegitimate. You don't belong to Him, because whom the Lord loves, He chooses to discipline. By the way, it's interesting, because in this context here, if you were looking at the Greek, you would see something. That when it deals with fathers and sons in this passage in verse 7, and talks about the father disciplining a son, he doesn't use the article with father or with son. Now, just hear me for a while. I will ask the question to some, and the rest of you can sit by while they answer, because I want to see if we've taught anything here. But you see, when there is an article, it emphasizes what? Identity. When there is no article, it emphasizes what? Quality. It's not the father and the son. It's anybody who happens to have the quality of a father is going to discipline his son. It's just, it is not the father, the son. It's one who is by quality father is certainly going to care enough to discipline one who is by quality son. Now, you know this was written in a different dispensation than this in which we live. But I got to tell you something, it's still the way God designed it to be. Don't be measuring this passage by present-day society and present-day opinions. May I also say something else to those of your fathers here? You go back, you look at this passage, you go back to the Old Testament, you understand the one ultimate responsible for the discipline, the care, the instruction of a child is not the mother, it is the father. One lady said to me, if I hadn't done it, it never would have been done. That's a pity. That's a pity. That is why in Ephesians chapter 6, it says, children, obey your parents. Then it says, not parents, but fathers. Why is he addressed the father? Because see, I as a father am the one ultimate responsible for the discipline, the instruction, the correction of my children. Oh, I didn't need all those times waiting your dad gets home, but by the same token, I am the one ultimately responsible, right? It is true. But you see, the point of this passage is the reason God disciplines me is because I am a legitimate child. I am not illegitimate. Isn't this what God does for a child? Then why in the wide world do we expect anything different from God? Even the question that comes when some people have gone through sickness, and by the way, got the email the other day that Dr. C.W. went into the presence of God. What a man of God. His wife suffered with cancer triumphantly. He then found he had cancer, and he, as he said when he spoke publicly a while back, he says, it's now my responsibility not only to teach people how to live, but teach them how to die, and he did. For the last few months, he's been longing to go home, but God kept him here for a reason, but his attitude never changed. And now coming back to this, the trials of life, when people look at that and people have said, you know, why should I ask why me? The question is, why not me? Why should God not do this in my life? You see, and when He does it in my life and it becomes more intense and more painful and more difficult, it is only the evidence of a God who loves so much that He reaches down to care for me and to uphold me and to make me what He wants me to be. And He can't get me there any other way. You understand something? You cannot be what God wants you to be without suffering. It won't happen. Cannot happen. Cannot happen. Cannot happen. Even if you look at the life of Christ, the pathway to glory is a pathway of what? Of suffering. And now walk with me quickly as we go through this, because you'll notice something now. He says, the understand the encouragement that accompanies the suffering, understand the position reflected by this, I'm a son of God. And then because of this, as you go down through verses 7 and 8, it is for discipline that you endure. And God deals with your sons, for what son is there whom his father does not discipline? And if you're without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you're illegitimate children, not sons. Therefore, my friend, if I go back to the first part of verse 5, the quotation, do not regard disregard or regard lightly the discipline of the Lord. Do you know, how many times did you say it as a father? How many times do I have to correct them and they don't learn? How many times do I have to spank him, turns around, does the same thing over again? This is the whole point. When God disciplines you through trials brought by other people, 'tis true, because God is in control of everything, you see, and God uses those things for his purpose. When God does that, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord. I mean, don't just let him do it to you and walk away without learning the lesson. Don't make him spank you time and time and time again till finally you say, Lord, I think I'm getting the message. He says, no, when God disciplines you, listen. See, the trial comes. We want to, you know, fight back against people who do it to us instead of looking at God and say, what are you trying to say to me? What do I have to learn because they publicly berated me this way? What do I have to learn because they took my house away and took every possession in the world I have? What are you trying to teach me? So the issue comes back here and he says, don't regard lightly the discipline of the Lord. Now walk with me quickly. Notice something else, and I do have to go, I suppose. Okay, watch this. The attitude. You know, verse 9 is significant. It is, they all are. By the way, no sons in here, by the way, just discipline. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Should we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? You know, another reason for discipline is to teach your children respect. I am bothered by this society. I am. United States, California, we respect nothing, nobody. I say that, that's a categorical statement. I hate categorical statements, and you know what I'm doing. It's overstatement. It is true. Teach my children from day one respect for older people. Now, you can do it if you want to. I don't want any 10-year-old of mine calling somebody who's 70 or 80 by their first name. I just don't want it to be. You say, why is it law? No, I just want them to learn respect. In the Old Testament, right side by side, honor the gray hair, fear God. Because I'm going to tell you what, when you don't learn respect for man, you don't learn respect for God either. And he says this. Now, God is the Father of spirits. What does that mean? Anyhow, let me tell you what it means just quickly. Father of spirits means that we sang about it. He's the Lord of everything, see. Listen to me. If he's a sovereign controller of everything, and the purpose of discipline in a home is to teach you respect for your father, and you respect your father through this, how much more should you submit yourself to God, right? Somehow the attitude in the midst of suffering is not to fight what God brings, but to submit to what God brings and to the God who brings it. And some of the statements we make in suffering do not reflect well upon the God who brought the suffering into our life. Directly or indirectly. Secondly, quickly, go on. Disciplinary suffering by God is for our good. Verse 10. Oh, this is a great statement. They disciplined us for a short time. It seemed best to them. You know what? I have disciplined my children over the years and sometimes look back and regretted what I disciplined them for. I have. In the early years, the pastor right here in this town, I corrected my oldest daughter because there were people thought my child should be a certain way because I'm the pastor, they're my child. It wasn't severe. It wasn't that kind of thing. I corrected her at times. I never should have corrected her. And I have apologized to her and asked her forgiveness. Won't do it again. You see, we make mistakes. Because we think it's for the right reason, but sometimes we don't discipline for the right reason. But we did what we thought was good at the time, right? Oh, the difference with God. Every time he does it, right? He doesn't make a mistake. No trial that comes in your life is a mistake. God can't make a mistake. He always does it right and for the right reason. Right? Look at this. Notice this. He does it for good, for our good. But notice the statement that we should share in His holiness. Oh my goodness, you know, if there's any purpose for discipline in the trials of life is to make me like Him. By the way, it's a rare term here. It's not found elsewhere like that. It's a very rare term. But you know what is the character of God? God is a holy God, and God is through trials trying to make me look like Him. It's true. We reflect on that passage in 1 Peter chapter 1. Our faith, proof part of our faith being more precious than gold which perishes, though being tried by fire. And when they tested the gold in those days, they would take it and put it under intense heat. And as the impurities rose, they skimmed it off and put it on the side. It was called ad docimos, and approved. And the part that was left to be heated was docimos, approved. And they kept doing this and doing this and doing this till all the impurities were out of the gold. And they say that the way that they knew it was time to quit is when the person who was processing the gold could look down and see a reflection of himself in the gold. My friend, God forever keeps processing my life because one day He wants to look down and see a reflection of Himself. That's what it's all about. Notice this next verse just quickly. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful. That's a fact. But sorrowful. That's true. But to those who have been trained, this is another term, an athletic term, afterwards it yields the fruit of righteousness. Let me start there. The substantial fruit of righteousness, which, by the way, is peaceful. But you know what? You want peace in your life. You come to terms with that process God's working out in your life to make you holy and righteous. And when you come to terms with the process, you will walk in a peaceful way before God, because that's what it's all about. And so many of us are wrestling without peace today because we cannot rest in the outer case of God. It's true. Now quickly, the conclusion of this. Go to verses 12 and 13. Therefore, he says, I told you all of this for this reason. Strengthen those feeble hands that are weak, and the knees that are feeble. You know what? It's time for us, if you go back, to stop losing heart and growing weary. I know my brother's a track coach. It was one of the things he do, and he was watching me do these races like that. He said, you know, get those arms up there because, see, when you've run too long, you start hanging your arms down and you're not running well. You got to get them back up there again. You see, somehow they just go down and you just can't run as well, and you're forcing yourself to do it. Listen to me. He says, strengthen those feeble hands. Those knees that are giving way and you say, I can't go any further. Make them strong. Listen to me. Face victoriously and triumphantly with seven people. But now look at the next verse. And it's amazing. And the NASB has messed it up, but that's all right. We'll trade it out. Take the italics out of there. The subject is the lame. It is the disabled. That's how many have translated. So let the disabled, okay? Make a straight way for your feet so the disabled may not have their feet turned. You know, we got some spiritually disabled people. They may be here in this body today, and I may be one of them, and you may be one of them. And you know what? They need help. They're spiritually disabled, and they can't make it. And somehow they need to make sure that their feet aren't turning the wrong way. And they need to do it, and you and I need to be there to help them. It's not just a matter of strengthening our hands and strengthening our knees. We need to help people who are spiritually lame to be able to walk this way too, so that we might triumphantly walk before God, and so that others whom we see around us might also triumphantly walk before God. See, this is a community of believers, and we're not going to let anybody struggle in the process, right? May God help us. The trials of life and the endurance of life is for our discipline. And the purpose of it is to bring us to a place of holiness and righteousness and therefore peace. You want peace today? Let God make you what He wants to be, what He wants you to be. It's not a joyful process. It's sorrowful at the time, but boy, in the end, it's so peaceful. and is so good. And He never, never, never makes a mistake. Father, again, we yield ourselves to You. The Father of all spirits, who does all things right. Lord, the trials I face this week, I yield into Your hands. Shape me into the image of Yourself, I pray. For Jesus' sake.